here this morning to introduce you to Spalding Gray. My guest is a storyteller and a fine actor, as well as being a great performer. Spalding Gray likes people and weaves his encounters with them into theater pieces. They're rather like fiber art filled with texture, knots, and found objects. The finished product is colorful, full of purposeful spaces, and it swings in the breeze while he looks through the openings. Good morning, Spalding Gray.
Good morning.
Do you always do monologues sitting behind a table with a glass of water?
I've done 14 that way. I think in one of the monologues I do stand up and go to a microphone briefly, Monster in a Box.
You use your hands a lot.
And my legs, hands, everything. I'm very connected at my spine to the chair. So it's like a kind of Zen posture, only I'm flailing about and working with my hands and legs. And one of the important things I've discovered about being at the table is it's a stasis point. So the audience gets lost, and they're no longer aware of time, because movement is time. And if I would get up to move, they'd be aware of time. So they go into a timeless state with the story, and the story becomes the thing.
And your sense of timing is excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And you must feel your audience out. Do you have different kinds of audiences?
Well, it's quite subtle, but I think there's a homogeneity amongst audiences that in America that I've experienced, that if I start out in a very honest, open, neutral way with them, where we're just one-on-one, because I don't consider what I'm doing solo. I consider it absolutely dialogue and dancing and making love to my audience. And if I start out with them and draw them in and we work on it together and dance together, then it's going to be consistently good. It's going to be connected.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think. The only audience I can think of that was a real dud on this whole tour was in Norwalk, Connecticut. And that's one of the reasons I don't live in the suburbs. Because before I even did the show, just the energy that was in that New York suburban environment was so depleting. I couldn't imagine the people coming to the show would have anything different from the houses that were there.
So that has a real effect on your energy, too.
Oh, I've got a minor cold now, and I'm getting through on the audience's energy. Yeah. Last night, you know, it was just, you know, I ride with them. You know, it's like riding a wave.
Yeah. You put a tremendous amount of feeling into your performances, and variety in tone and I was saying texture. And sometimes you use time in a way that you, and I noticed that Randy Gregg mentioned this morning in his coverage, that you throw out a sentence and let it sit in the air. Then how can you remember so well that you can then attach everything together so perfectly?
I don't write the monologues. I only speak them in front of an audience. So they start as original memory. So the first narrative is the way in which I remember. So I'm seeing a film in my head as I'm speaking.
Mm-hmm.
There are no lines to remember. There's only looking at the past. Then there's a reshaping of original memory to make it more dramatic. So there's a structural thing that happens. And I do tapes, and I listen, and I redo an outline that I'm working from. So what I only have to remember is the progression of the stories. The stories themselves, I am seeing vividly in my head as I'm telling them. I am simply describing a memory film.
I see. Well, now, how many of these monologues have you written?
Well, I don't write them, you see.
I'm
an oral writer.
Have you outlined?
Right. I've spoken them. It's a kind of oral writing, and I think I'm on this is 14. Yeah, this is the 14th.
The reason I asked if they were written is because I'm looking at this little book called Gray's Anatomy.
Right. Gray's Anatomy is published by Vintage. I highly recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
It's at Paul's Bookstore, but it's a transcription that's reworked.
I see.
So after I work on the monologue for 2 years, we sometimes do films of them. We always do books. And so we get a transcription, and then with the editor, I try to shape it into something that's more easily read.
And you have then transcripts and tapes of all of the monologues that you have done.
Oh, yes, because I do a tape every performance from the beginning. working with the director, Renee Shafransky. And Renee and I would sit down the next morning and listen to the performance through and stop and start and go back. And rewrite constantly. We reshape. See, all of the stories are true. They're all coming from an actual fact, but they are rearranged to, for, you know, for dramatic effect.
Mm-hmm. They're all about your personal life, aren't they? And they mm-hmm. have to do with very personal things that have happened to you.
Right.
And they also involve people that you've met.
Yeah.
It's true that you have a great interest in the personal lives of other people, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. When they are, how shall I say, strange enough. Because I think of myself often as a strange attractor. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult for me to see a person whose neurosis is not full-blown. You see, I'm a Freudian to the extent that I feel everyone's neurotic, in the sense that culture causes neurosis through sublimation. So sublimation means that we're not free, we're sublimating for the greater good of the culture, you know, in a Freudian sense. And I get very annoyed when people call me a neurotic, because we're all in this boat together. But I happen to notice what I would call strange characters. Mm-hmm. And I go for them, and they go for me. We gravitate toward each other. And the monologue is often filled with those kind of oddities. And mm-hmm. people think that I'm making this up a lot of the time. But all of these characters in the monologue are real people I met. And they become characters in the sense that I'm selective about what I tell about them. Mm-hmm. But I get annoyed sometimes when certain critics, and they're not that many, refer to me as solipsistic or navel-gazing. I don't understand that. And they do this because they see me alone on stage and they don't realize I'm playing all these different voices. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about people I encountered. But they get confused sometimes because they just see, well, he's the only one up there talking, therefore he must be navel-gazing. Well, I'm not.
I don't think so either. And I have a question here, and it may be repetitious. I was going to ask you, you seem to attract odd incidents and collect them to use in your work. Would you describe what kind of collecting you do?
Well, that kind of collecting is what I do. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Grey's Anatomy has a nutritional ophthalmologist in it. And he lives with his brother in Lake Hiawatha, New Jersey. And I found out about him through an alternative health program on Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Gary Null recommended that I go see this man. When I got to his house, it was unbelievably eccentric. The situation defied, I couldn't even grasp for the story. To remember, I'd have to keep going back and taking notes. Mm-hmm. The brother was, they all wore bottle-thick glasses. The brother used to sing for the Metropolitan Opera. So he had a quadraphonic opera playing. He's asking me what I've eaten over the past 6 months. The mother is 91 years old, and she's still cross-country skiing. On and on and on. You'd have to see the monologue to get, or read the book, because the monologue sold out. You can get the book. It's a wonderful story. But I had to change everything. Vintage made me change everything in the book, and Lincoln Center would like me to change names, so I'd made him Dr. Ron A. Axe and put him in Nutley, New Jersey instead of Lake mm-hmm. Hiawatha, and his name is Ben C. Lane. So I opened the monologue at Lincoln Center and I get this call on my answering machine saying, "Hello, Spalding, this is Dr. Ben C. Lane from Lake Hiawatha. I would appreciate it if you gave me a call." I said, "Oh boy, that's it. They're gonna sue. It's just, oh boy." So I didn't call him back. I called my lawyer. What should I do? Well, just let it go. He kept calling. Mm-hmm. And he finally said, "We've heard you're performing a piece that we're in, and we really want to see it. We've bought the book, and we love it. Mm-hmm. We have it up on our wall. Please try to get us tickets." So I said, "All right, I'll try to get you tickets." And then he called. I talked to him. He said, "Can my brother get up and sing an aria from Puccini at the end of your monologue at Lincoln Center?" Really. I mean, I realized they were quite mad. And I said, "Well, it's a union problem." And he said, "Well, could we have a follow spot on him in the audience? Because I'm going to come with his mother's 91, his brother, his brother sang that. They got these bottle-thick glasses. They're completely weird. They show up at the show. I think there's no way they can possibly condone this. I see it as total, like, showing them up as being quite mad. They're afterwards, they want to be photographed with me. The mother's 91. She's talking about the cross-country skiing that she's still doing. And then a week later, I get a note from them, and it's notarized. And it's saying, requesting that I change their names to their real names and change Nutley, New Jersey back to Lake Hiawatha. So there you are.
There you are. Yeah, there
I'm incredulous.
And there they were.
Yeah, yeah.
There, are they still heckling you to...
Well, I'm not. I haven't been in New York in months, you know, but I'm sure when I get back and reopen the show, they'll want to...
There'll be one more of them faxes.
Wanna, yeah, sing opera.
Something
at the end
will
of
have
the...
to be done. Oh, yeah. Dear. Well, that's a great story, too. And the next question that I was going to ask you is that you seem to have a lot of exasperation and fun all at once.
Mm-hmm.
You seem to be enjoying yourself when you're doing this.
Yeah.
But if you do it so many times, how can you keep that spontaneity and that combination?
I use acting techniques. I'm a trained actor.
Yes.
I went to Emerson College, and I got my equity card at the Alley Theater in Houston, Texas, and played off-Broadway in plays and was in Our Town. And so I you know, I go out. I'm a professional, and I now know the material, and I go out and I act as though I don't know it. I act as though I don't know where I'm beginning. If you saw, particularly last night, because my energy was a little low, I come out and I go, I think that it all began the summer that I turned 50. So the audience really feels like I'm just making it up on the spot because I'm acting that way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, an interesting thing happened in Santa Barbara on the tour. I started out like that, very low, and the microphone, I guess, wasn't high enough, and a woman yelled out from the audience, we can't hear you. Would you turn your microphone up? I was pretty annoyed, so I go, I have no way to turn my microphone up. The control booth does it, so could you turn it up in the control booth? Oh boy, I said, here we go. Every time I work with techies, they'll never answer back. They pretend they're not there. Can you turn the microphone up?
Mm-hmm.
Is anyone else having problem hearing? No. Well, do we need it up? Yes. All right, turn it up. All right. So I start the show again, and I go. So I think it all began the summer that I turned 50. Oh, someone goes, a little louder, please. Oh, I'll stop it again. This went on for three times. And I started a show over three different times. And it was interesting because each time was a study in a different way of beginning. And the audience absolutely loved it.
Yes.
Absolutely thought she was a plant. Absolutely thought she was part of the act. You know, they always integrate.
Yes.
Because they're in an open, childlike state.
Oh, good, yes.
Now, what I wanted to say about that is that afterwards I did a book signing on stage. And this guy comes up to me, quite arrogant, from L.A. He'd come up from L.A. to see the show, and he said, you're not really talking to us. You're acting. I said, and how do you know that? Because you were really talking to that woman. You asked her name. Her name was Mary. And I said, yeah, I do an act up here. I'm sorry to disappoint you. I was really talking to her. I'm also really talking to you, but I'm doing the same material, so I have to act as though it's fresh, so it doesn't sound rote. So it's like a method actor would work, you know.
Sure.
It's I'm acting. I am a performer in the sense I'm doing a performance, but I'm a trained actor and I use that technique.
Sure. The other night you mentioned a name of somebody in I can't remember what part of your monologue it was, but you used the name something Proctor.
John Proctor, one of my relatives, yes.
Yes, your relatives. You were
from the family tree.
Listing your relatives.
And someone reacted to that night.
And somebody reacted to that, and you looked out over the audience at this person, and there was a moment of a very full silence.
Yes.
You, well done.
Yeah.
Is all
Thank
I can
you.
Say.
And you know how I differ, say, from someone who's improvising or a stand-up comedian is that all I did was look and let the silence sit, and then the audience can do what they want with that, rather than doing some sort of glib ad lib around the name John Proctor, or if you've got a problem with that, or were you related to him? You know, I try to stay right with the text, but if someone does a very odd reaction, that's when I will just take a break and just look.
Yes.
And let it sit.
Mm-hmm. Somebody said, and I'm asking you if this is fair, Spalding Gray, too much of an edgy contemporary urban ironist. Do you think that's a fair statement?
Too much for what?
Yeah.
I mean, who said this? Is it, are you sure he wasn't talking about me in our town? That's the only time the critics went after me for being too dark, and they wanted a winking stage manager. So every critic in New York attacked me for my grave
emotions.
It's
very likely that that's where I picked up that.
Too. Yeah, too much of an edgy what?
An edgy contemporary urban ironist.
Oh yeah, I'm. That's what I am.
Uh huh.
I don't know if it's too much of that.
Why not?
I mean,
what's wrong with that?
Yeah, what is too much? That's what I'd have to ask that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, too much for what?
I was just wondering.
Am I sinking his ship?
Yeah. Are you going to, would you add to that or?
Well, I work with irony, and I think that any culture that loses a sense of irony is down the hole, and I think that's one of the things that's happening in America now.
Mm-hmm.
There's a terrific literal-mindedness afoot. And particularly, and I hate to say this because it's a lovely place and I love to play there, but the Bay Area is so worried about being spiritually and politically correct that they actually have a lag time between their reactions now. Like on the radio, the radio has a lag time, so they can't say the seven deadly words. Mm-hmm. You can cut it off. Well, I had a sense of that now when I performed, that the people are testing it out. When I say the Japanese have a kind of kamikaze energy.
Yes.
You know, that line, you know, it plays mm-hmm. in certain places right away. In New York, they'll go right for it. But in mm-hmm. other places, they'll go, wait a minute, is this a racist remark? Can we laugh at this? So there's a kind of, there's a terrific cautiousness going on now.
Yes, I know.
And top-downness, you know, and a lack of irony.
And does this get in your way?
No, because I feel I'm pushing through it and I'm there to triumph over it, certainly working with
good.
Irony.
Yeah.
And that's the only time I ever played in a city with no irony. It was just terrifying. It was at Perth, Australia, and it's the most isolated city in the world. And it's a nouveau-rich city, and it's a new city, and they have no irony there. It just hasn't reached there. And so when I did Swimming to Cambodia, no one laughed once. They all thought everything they took everything I said literally. They had no concept of hyperbole, and I work enormously with hyperbole,
mm-hmm.
which, if I have to remind you, means to throw beyond in the creed.
Okay.
Yeah.
How about being called an existentialist humorist?
Well, that's a good one. I think I used that myself. I don't know where you picked that one up. That was just a recent word that I decided I'd combine those, maybe in an interview, because I have been reconnecting with the existentialists. I did an interview with the Dalai Lama for Tricycle Magazine, a Buddhist publication here, and I backed the Dalai Lama up against a wall around this concept of reincarnation, and I felt that that my heroes were the existentialists, particularly Becker in his writings, The Dial of Death. And to some extent, Freud and Sartre, but in the sense that they're bowing down to the mystery. They're saying, we may all die and consciousness will end there. And can we live in that? And how do we live morally in the face of that?
Mm.
You know, I see the Tibetans and Catholics as similar, that they're doing an afterlife trip on you to frighten you into, you know, I mean, the Gelupa Tibetan school is not unlike the Jesuits, the Dalai Lama's school.
Mm-hmm.
They say that your chances of being reborn as a human being are, and here's the image, it's very like joyous, there's a ring, a wooden ring floating on the top of the Pacific Ocean, randomly up there, just a teeny wooden ring. And there's a turtle on the bottom of the ocean. And every 100 years, that turtle randomly surfaces, and that random ring is there. And the chances of that turtle going through that ring's head is your chance of getting reborn as a human being so that you can then work out your karma and not be reborn as a scorpion. Well, that's just like Joyce, for God's sakes. It's like out of a portrait of an artist, it's hellfire and brimstone. I think the existentialists, for me, are the great heroes.
Good. All right. We're getting close to I don't know whether we're going out to Pledge Central or not. I hope not, because I want to talk to you some more. We have a lot to say.
No, we're going on for all day.
Yeah, but you have a cold. I'm so pleased that you came this morning, and I think it was very generous of you, because I know you don't feel too well, and you have to perform
well,
again tonight.
Tonight, and you
and
know,
I
the
appreciate
performance
it,
takes a lot of energy.
And I'm sure that the listeners appreciate it too. And I hope.
But they should go out and buy the book at Powell's if they can't get in to see the show.
Know? I think they should buy the work. And
because the book has more stories in it than the monologue. It's a little longer, so it's more
it?
Complete. Yeah, the monologue had to be cut down just a little bit for time purposes.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, it's possible that they can still get tickets if they
uh-huh.
hurry. There may be 6 or 8 tickets left at the performances, which will be tonight and Friday night and Saturday night. So you can still keep trying, people, if you want to see Spalding Gray at the Portland Art Museum in the Berg Swan Auditorium.
I think they have waitlisting. They have waitlisting, yeah.
Have what?
Waiting list.
A waiting list, yeah. They do.
Yeah,
well,
some tickets.
Too bad. Buy the work then, and or the tapes. Where are the tapes available? Do you know?
I don't know if Paul's has the tapes, but the Gang of Seven.
They probably, Music Millennium probably has them.
Gang of Seven is the people that are making the tapes.
Gang of Seven.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We'll try to get that information then a little bit more thoroughly and hand it out to people out there on the air. And that's what you can get from KBOO 90.7 FM. People, please remember to pledge 232-8818, 1-800-949-5266.
Well, Julie, why should people who listen to Art Focus call up at 232-8818 and become a member?
Why not? That's what we really want. That's what I'm trying to say, in fact. But
you've been giving our listeners a lot of reason to become KBOO members over the last 6 months. Not only this interview with Spalding Gray, but a wide number of other interviews you've done.
That's true, Margaret. And I want to ask a few more questions. Do I have any more time?
Probably need to wrap it up right now, and let's go out to our members and ask for some support for the show.
Well, we're not at all finished here this morning, and in fact, it's just begun. And I just enjoyed speaking with you, and I'm sure the listeners enjoyed listening to you.
Good, yeah.
Spalding Gray, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure. Really, I wish you well with the show and your fundraising.
Thanks so much. And this is Julie Bernard and Art Focus.